Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program, a 700 billion rand scandal. South Africa's procurement fraud bill could rival a year of tax revenue. Food inflation is steady, but meat prices are exploding. What's really happening in your grocery basket? Slow growth, steady risk rating. Are investors still giving South Africa the benefit of the doubt? And hiring without borders. Is this the great marketing reset? And what does it mean for South African jobs? It's Thursday, the 19th of February. Now, new estimates are suggesting procurement fraud and irregular expenditure may have cost South Africa as much as 700 billion rand. Despite years of reform, scandals continue and consequence management remains painfully slow. It's a worrying situation. Paul Vos is with me now from the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply, and he says that compliance alone is not going to fix the system. Fundamentally, behavior has also got to change. Paul, a very warm welcome to you, and let's get to that 700 billion rand. It is a staggering number. How realistic is that?
It's very realistic, Jeremy. We have a very strong legislative framework in South Africa. The issue isn't that our reforms are focused overwhelmingly on compliance, so the paperwork, the processes, instead of the actual behaviours and the capabilities that we need to apply that legislation effectively. So you end up with a system that looks really, really good on paper, but it doesn't always work in practice. So that's a situation we find ourselves in.
So it's about behavior and capability. Where specifically then does it fail in practice if the reforms look good on paper?
I think one of the biggest issues is around capability. So we place these highly complex, high value procurement responsibilities on people who don't necessarily have the training as procurement professionals. And even, the best legislation can't compensate for that capability gap. And another issue that we see quite a lot from SIPS's perspective is around misaligned authority. So junior staff often do all the operational work, while senior officials who may not have the requisite procurement expertise are the ones who are approving decisions. So that mismatch then leads to bottlenecks and inconsistent judgment. There's also, on the contract side, there's often contract misalignment as well, which is arguably where most of the problems lie. So many audit findings we see don't come from the tender process itself, but from what happens after the award. So after the award, there's issues like weak oversight, there's scope creep, and we're familiar with many government projects in South Africa that have extensive scope creep. There's late delivery, there's poor supplier management. So all those issues are fundamental. And then, around the professional independence, procurement can't be done well when officials are under pressure, and whether that pressure is political or internal. So without that independence, good governance collapses. So that's where we see some of the fundamental issues.
How big an obstacle is political interference then when it comes to clean procurement?
So, look, I think that there's interference on multiple levels, and really, I think that political interference really plays a part in terms of ensuring that there's transparency around tender processes. So what we're seeing is that we need to divorce the political side of governance from the process of awarding tenders and awarding contracts to suppliers. And I think that the political side of things really, given our history and given some of the issues that are in the public space, really needs proper attention from our lawmakers.
You don't think that process has just become too entrenched? It's almost impossible to fix now. It's almost part of the currency of the deal.
I'm a glass half empty person, so I do think that there's opportunity for us to shift. I think there are opportunities. You know, if we look at systems like e-procurement systems, if we look, you know, have transparency around suppliers, if we have transparency around benefication, I do think that there are opportunities for us to arrest this issue. But it's going to take a massive amount of effort. And, you know, I think that what is interesting is that if we look at some of our neighboring countries, they've already implemented e-procurement systems. And in South Africa, I'm led to believe that National Treasury is only looking at perhaps March 2027 to introduce an e-procurement system. So once those types of systems come into place, there's a lot more transparency. And that transparency then leads to, you know, public confidence. It leads to much higher visibility around what is happening with the public purse and public spending.
I accept that, but there is the argument, of course, that digital procurement designed to reduce fraud, but there's also the risk of just creating new workarounds.
Well, you know, I think this is the thing about the e-procurement systems. There are a multitude of different platforms available to procurement professionals. And this is why we need to be very, very cautious about which e-procurement systems we adopt. And obviously that we have to ensure that any workarounds within those systems have a very robust and transparent audit process, so that any workarounds can be, again, need to be visible, need to be transparent, and need to be available to all key stakeholders in terms of justification for those workarounds.
Paul, I mentioned in my introduction consequence, and the reality or the problem that I see is that senior officials very rarely face swift consequences for procurement failure. Unless that side of the equation is dealt with, the argument that, or the discussion we're having here is just academic, surely.
Yeah, I think that's true, because behavior doesn't change just because rules exist. And, and it changes when incentives line up with the outcomes that we as citizens really, really want. So at the moment, most officials are more afraid of making an admin mistake than making a poor commercial decision. So that dynamic has to change. So what we need to do is, and I've mentioned this earlier, around professionalization is important. So we need to professionalize procurement. And if you think about it, you wouldn't let somebody practice as an accountant or an engineer without proper credentials. So procurement officials really need to hold some sort of recognized professional qualification. We, from our experience, we see that many, many practitioners in the public sector are seconded from other parts of the business, whether it's operations or finance. So they don't necessarily have those skills. So when you raise the bar to entry, decision-making improves immediately. Then around consequences, we need predictability around the consequences. So at the moment, there's a lot of inconsistency, as we mentioned already. Also, it's influenced by politics, unfortunately. So if someone knowingly breaks the rules, there should be automatic sanctions, whether it's around their loss of delegation or suspension of a professional registration or blacklisting in serious cases. When people know those consequences are real, then behavior will shift. But until that happens, we're not going to see a shift. And I think it's also important to be able to reward outcomes, not just compliance. So if we have clean audits, if we are able to reduce irregular expenditure, if we see and experience better supplier performance, those are indicators really of good procurement. So when institutions recognize and reward that, people start focusing on results rather than just the box-ticking exercise, which doesn't really bring us the results that we need in terms of addressing this critical issue.
Thank you very much indeed. In conversation there with Paul Vos from the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Let's move on to your supermarket trolley now. And food inflation looks calm on the surface, steady at 4.4% in January. But beneath that number, there is serious pressure building in the meat aisle. Beef prices are up by as much as 35% year on year. Pork is climbing fast, and foot and mouth disease and African swine fever are disrupting supply. At the same time, cereal prices are falling sharply thanks to lower maize costs and good rains. So are we looking at a temporary degree of pain here, or maybe the start of a broader food price squeeze? Paul Makube is with us now, senior agricultural economist at FNB Commercial. Paul, thank you as always for talking to us. A headline food inflation steady, 4.4%, as I said, but meat is surging. Is the overall number hiding real stress for consumers, do you think?
Thanks for having me. Yes, indeed, on the meat side, there's huge pressure there. As indicated, the surge in meat prices, especially for January, which is unseasonal. Normally, we have a slowdown in January post the December holidays. 13.5% increase for January is quite steep. And actually, at that level is actually an eight-year high. So indications are that we are dealing with a disease outbreak that is going to take longer to resolve. And therefore, the disruptions to the trading environment will continue for quite a while. And therefore, we expect that meat prices will remain elevated for a bit.
Paul, if you look at one particular cut of meat, beef rump is up nearly 220 rand a kilo. That's up 35% in a year. You've mentioned the disease problem that the industry is facing, but would there be deeper structural issues when it comes to the meat sector, do you think?
Not necessarily. The only thing that has actually impacted on the market is that outbreak of the disease, which has impacted on domestic supplies. As indicated, trading has been disrupted. An outbreak causes, quarantine. It causes movement of animals being restricted and so on. Therefore, it creates uncertainty in the trading environment. Hence, the scare to get supplies and therefore prices, increasing.
And this raises serious questions about poor biosecurity management, doesn't it?
Yes, biosecurity management has actually lapsed, and then there is a recognition of that nationally, and hence the decision to actually embark on a long-term process of dealing with the disease in terms of national vaccination, of which we have seen currently that it is currently underway. There are indications that we will be receiving about 1 million doses of the vaccine to deal with the disease. But that's a long-term process to get back to normality.
Well, let's assume that that works. If the vaccination efforts maybe are successful, outbreaks fall considerably in the next 12 months or so. Paul, how quickly do retail prices actually respond to some success in that space?
Well, that will be quick. Assuming that that happens, it will be relatively quick to get back to normal, because you then return back to the normal situation of supply and demand, being in balance with exports. There are some countries indicating that they can take exports with vaccination. Others are still are more stricter. So, definitely we might see a situation where we have a normalization of the situation and prices dissipating.
Paul, on the flip side, maize prices are down almost 50% year on year. Why are consumers not feeling that relief more clearly at the till?
Yeah, that one is actually was a surprise package, because we've been monitoring it over time. Over the past 7 months, we have seen a massive deceleration in the price of maize. Actually, maize prices, falling sharply, in the last 7 months. And we were yet to see that, significant pass through to the consumer. But now recently, with, cereal inflation at, single digit level, even below 1% at 0.6% year on year, that is an indication of the filtering through of producer prices to the consumer. So that is likely to remain that way for quite a while, fortunately for the consumer. Even the domestic, oversupply situation, we have a huge carryover stock from the bumper crop last year. We have planted more area under grains this year. Indications are that we're likely to see another decent crop or harvest into 2026. The other thing is that you have a very, strong exchange rate, obviously, given the fact that you know, our grain prices are, you know, export parity based. You know, a stronger exchange rate puts pressure on domestic prices. So as we see this sustained trend in downward trend in grain prices.
Paul, let me move from grains to vegetables and fruit now, which are in deflation. So I think it might raise the question of whether we see substitution, in other words, consumers shifting away from meat. If that's the case, does that stabilize in any way inflation?
Well, the vegetable situation is a function of a supply in the country. I think on the back of favorable production conditions, you know, distant rains, we have a, you know, decent supply of, you know, of vegetables. On the question of substitution, if there was substitution and a level of resistance at for higher meat prices, we could have seen meat prices coming down significantly. But that does not necessarily mean a substitution. So the consumer is still able to pay for the higher, you know, meat prices. So perhaps it's a question of the lower, you know, prices of other correct categories actually subsidizing meat in this case in the consumer basket.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul Makube, Senior Agricultural Economist at FNB Commercial.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's growth remains modest. Unemployment, as you well know, is stubbornly high and global volatility persists. Yet, Allianz Trade has kept the country's risk rating stable in its 2026 Country Risk Atlas. Luis Dalmau, economist for Africa and the Middle East at Allianz Trade, joins me now to take a look at what stable really means, where the pressure points lie, and whether corporates should take some comfort or still remain a little anxious and cautious. Luis, a very warm welcome to you. When you say South Africa's risk rating is stable, what does that mean for businesses on the ground?
Yeah, it means that South Africa as an economy over the last 12 months has actually improved. As we have seen over the last 12 months, we have seen a country that it used to have issues with things as basic as electricity supply to now have being rid of almost of load shedding. We are seeing also a lot of increase in mining output coming out of South Africa. And so we're seeing an improvement when it comes down to just basic economic growth in the country. And so over the last 12 months, we have maintained this risk outlook for South Africa because we've seen this improvement. I think the key question moving forward is, can South Africa see this risk reduce and can we actually upgrade the profile of the country?
Growth of 1.3% this year and 1.5% next year, you will agree, is modest. In your opinion, then, what do you think is preventing the economy from breaking into a higher gear?
I agree with you that it's modest, but I think it's also important to put these numbers in perspective. As I was just saying, just a couple of years ago, the country was even growing by lower standards. So I think these 1.3 and 1.5, which I think are actually a bit conservative, and we most likely will be upgrading moving forward these numbers a bit higher, are telling us that the economy is starting to turn the page slowly, as you're saying, but it's starting to move a bit better. And so I think the key risks for the country are basically, first of all, applying the supply, basically. What does that mean? That means that for South Africa to be able to function, it needs for infrastructure to work. And I think that is going to be key, making sure that the entirety of, let's say, as I mentioned, that electricity, water supply, of roads, of rail, of airports, of ports are actually working much better. That on one hand. And then I think there's other risks that are also coming from outside. Of course, the tariff threat that we know that is there and present. And then secondly, of course, the global financial conditions. We don't know what's exactly going to happen to the Fed moving forward, to the Federal Reserves in the United States. And I think that's something to really keep an eye on moving forward.
There's no doubt that infrastructure and energy reforms are positives. But I guess the question many of us in South Africa are asking is, how durable do you think these gains are? And perhaps more importantly, from a risk perspective, what do you think could derail them?
Yes, I think that's the key point, right? Now that at least some of the economy in South Africa is returned to some, let's say, normal functioning, I think the key question is, okay, where do we go from here? Because as you said, in the short term, this is going to help growth, but moving towards the longer term, there's not much more that, you know, that an improved road can bring to economic growth. That's already there. And so the starting point is better than the past. So I think there's some questions that will need to be asked, and I hope business leaders and also policymakers in South Africa are doing and are asking themselves on where should growth be coming from. Does South Africa want to become a more of a financial center in the future? Does it want to bring more tourists and become more of a touristic hub? Does it want to still be a very important manufacturing hub? Those are all important questions to keep in mind moving forward, because yes, infrastructure will only go so far.
And you're absolutely right when you talk about growth and the key questions that we've got to ask. But against that backdrop, youth unemployment remains stubbornly extremely high in this country. I just wonder, again, in your opinion, how much of a structural risk that is to long-term stability and to investor confidence.
Yes, I think that's one of the key points. I think the human capital of South Africa is one of its biggest assets, but also one of its biggest risks, because as you said, unemployment is very high, and that seems that for now it's not going away. And then I think a key structural issue is this mismatch between the jobs that are needed and the skills that people have. So I think for investors, this is going to be a key question, because why would a multinational company go and invest in South Africa when, yes, it has a lot of people available to be employed, right? But those people don't match the skills that a company needs for its operations. Let's say, as I said, from manufacturing to finances or anything else. And so I think there, it's a key question that needs to be tackled for South Africa to grow in the longer term.
It was interesting to see your note on the upside as far as South Africa's removal from the Financial Action Task Force grey list is. You listed as positive. I'm wondering at this point if we're seeing any concrete changes in capital flow, or do you think it's still too early to call that?
No, I think what we experienced already over last year or part of last year was already thanks to that. I think last year South Africa saw one of the largest increases of capital inflows going into the country, at least in the last decade. And what that shows is that there's more appetite that with the improvement that the country, at least some of improvements of the country has had, and also, of course, the changes internationally with the perception and appetite for the US dollar, what's happening, of course, to the gold and gold markets, all that combined together with the removal of this grey listing, I think it has improved. And I think that, again, it will be positive for capital flows. It's positive as well for banks. It's positive for any important exporter that needs to settle and it needs to access hard currency. So I think overall, besides the momentum, the increase of capital flows, it's also partially the same.
So let me ask you in conclusion then, if you were advising a multinational looking at South Africa this year, is there a single risk that you would tell them to monitor most closely?
Yes, I think one big risk is to keep an eye exactly on what we're talking about. Is your growth wanting to be more on the longer term? If that is the case, you have to be careful on where, what sectors you're investing. You need to make sure that in the longer term, you're gonna have access to that human capital that you're going to need. I think that's going to be the key, the most key point for investors moving forward.
Thank you very much indeed. In conversation there with Luis Dalmau, economist for Africa and the Middle East at Allianz Trade.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I read that global marketing hiring is picking up again, but this is not a return to packed offices and bloated teams. Instead, as I understand it, firms are building lean, senior-led distributed teams that plug into international clients across a number of time zones. It's an interesting concept. Now, André van der Merwe is General Manager for EMA at Brand Tech Plus. It's a global collective of creative thinkers. And he's going to join us now to discuss why this rebound looks very different this time, and also how artificial intelligence is reshaping roles rather than replacing them. And I guess what all of this means for South African talent competing on a global stage. Andre, a very warm welcome. So business confidence is edging higher. Recruiter searches, as I mentioned, are up. But maybe the question is, how real is the rebound and how much of it is simply a low base effect after what has been a very tough period?
Yeah, I think one could probably sort of frame it somewhere in between recovery and a redesign. But I think it's also both. You know, if we're honest, I think the recovery part of the story is it's a bit of a smaller headline. The bigger headline, I think, is the industry has quietly changed its operating system. I think there's renewed confidence and the hiring is definitely picking up, but companies aren't rebuilding the old world, you know, where success meant, I think, big offices, big teams, and big overheads. They're sort of rebuilding around delivery. And that's a bit of a shift, you know, that rebuilding around output, speed, quality, and accountability. It's essentially where the talent happens to live. So I think what's emerging is more of a redesign. And it's really focused on distributed teams that serve global clients across markets and time zones, with far less sort of obsession about where you sit and far more focused on what it is that you ship. And at Brandtech Plus, you know, we always say we're not hiring to fill desks, right? What we're doing is building stable, senior, high-performing team. And I think that model is designed to last because it matches what clients want now.
Now, all of that makes perfect economic sense. So you're building lean, senior-led teams. But there is a downside, surely. It would mean fewer entry-level opportunities for younger people in this country, surely.
Yeah, listen, there's definitely entry-level talent still has a place. But I think the job description has changed. The old model often used juniors as a kind of human glue, you know, doing the admin, doing the repetitive production work, moving files around, endless sort of versioning. And I think AI is now swallowing a lot of that, which is honestly fine. You know, I don't think anyone is getting into advertising and marketing because they want to rename layers in Photoshop for 8 hours a day, you know. So where do the graduates fit in? I think they fit in where the future is, you know. They're the fast learners inside a senior-led team building real skills quickly. I think the winning model here is the senior-led pod or an incubator where juniors get mentored and get exposed to real client work early, you know, not stuck in the busy work dungeon. And also, I think the expectations are a bit high. You know, graduates will need AI literacy as a baseline, strong fundamentals in craft and communication, and a sort of a figure-it-out mindset. You know, if you combine curiosity with discipline, and you can actually deliver work, then you'll do well. If you're waiting for someone, I don't know, to hand you a neat, slow-moving career ladder, I think that ladder is being replaced by a climbing wall.
There's no doubt that the paradigm is changing. Andre, you talk about artificial intelligence speeding up production. I understand that. But there are jobs that are therefore at risk, and there is a place where demand is actually increasing. What does that new shift look like in reality on the shop floor, so to speak?
Yeah, I think it sounds a bit counterintuitive because we keep framing AI like it's, I don't know, a robot marching into the studio carrying a cardboard box of your belongings, yeah. Right? But I think in reality, what AI is mostly doing is removing friction, right? It's speeding up drafts, resizing assets, generating variations, accelerating ideation, and, you know, a lot of other things, localizing, testing, iterating. So I think what happened is that the bottleneck is moving. The bottleneck now becomes the judgment, the taste, the strategy, the decision making, the brand governance. In other words, the human stuff, right? AI can still generate the 200 options for us, but it can't tell us, you know, which of those three options are the right ones for the brand, the audience at the moment. So I think, so the demand increases in hybrid roles, you know, creatives who can think strategically, strategists who can work with data, designers who are AI fluent, you know, and project leads who can run multi-market workflows without, you know, everything catching on fire. And I think you also see more of a demand for quality control and brand safety, because moving faster, you know, you need stronger guardrails. So I think AI does the heavy lifting, but humans still do the heavy thinking. And I think that's where the hiring pressure is shifting.
And just one final question, and I'll ask you to be brief if possible. Against this backdrop then, Andre, how difficult is it for South African professionals to price themselves in a global market without racing to the bottom on cost?
Short answer, I think not so difficult. Listen, if it was a race to the bottom, you know, companies would hire masses of juniors, pay the lowest possible rates, and treat people like disposable inputs. But I think instead, what we're seeing is firms hiring selectively and often more senior than before, because priority is delivery and trust. And being remote is just the delivery mechanism, right? The actual goal is to build teams that can move fast, stay consistent, and be accountable without, you know, 12 layers of approvals. At Brandtech Plus specifically, we've opened 100 full-time remote roles across creative, strategy, account management, and other discipline as well. And that's not cheap outsourcing, right? That's permanent team building. And I don't think you do that if you only care about shaving rent costs.
Well, that certainly is a look at the future in this particular sector. Andre van der Merwe, thank you very much indeed. General Manager for Europe, Middle East and Africa at Brandtech Plus. Appreciate your time. Thank you. And that's it for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.